Belgian police fired tear gas and water cannons to disperse thousands of protesters in Brussels who were objecting to COVID restrictions. An international aid agency says a recent Saudi strike on a prison in Yemen was unjustifiable and that there is no way to deny the attack. Plus, Iraq's popular mobilization units launch a large-scale operation against Daesh terrorists in the east of the country. Hello and welcome to your world news, coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Anger boils in the Belgian capital, where thousands come out to protest COVID restrictions in their country. Things got ugly when police tried to disperse the protesters. The demonstrators marched through Brussels to the European Union headquarters. They were angry at vaccinations and the so-called health passes the government has introduced to contain the virus. The latest measure was announced on Friday. Based on that, people should take booster shots after 5 months in order to be able to attend public places like cinemas. That will take effect on March the 1st. The protesters say the measure is against our freedom. In the past week, daily COVID infections have surged to over 60,000 in Belgium, with authorities describing it as a tsunami. Our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, tells us more about the protests there and explains why Belgians are against COVID restrictions.
But the organizers did try and call for people from right across the European Union to attend today. They're actually organizing another one for the end of this month as well. But what we've seen in the past with similar protests is they do become quite violent. There are clashes with police. Now, I have to say, compared to previous protests, I've never seen such a large police presence right around the European Commission and those institution buildings. And, you know, you have so many people who are young people in particular in precarious jobs. Lots of people have been told that they have to work from home. Their hours have been reduced. Some people are allowed to go back into work in the office, but they don't know, or wherever they're working, but they don't know what their long-term future holds. There's so much uncertainty. And we've had a situation in the EU whereby, you know, we have high inflation, we have very high energy costs, and we have a situation that governments have been providing subsidies to basically try and keep jobs afloat during the pandemic. But those subsidies now are slowly being withdrawn. And that means that businesses that were getting help to keep people employed, their grants are being taken away. Therefore, then we see the real picture. We see the real decisions being taken by bosses to reduce the workforce because they no longer have these pandemic payments.
The resignation of Germany's Navy chief fails to pacify Ukrainian authorities angered by his pro-Russian remarks. Ukraine's ambassador to Germany says the departure is insufficient to restore full trust in German politics. In a tweet, the ambassador accused Germany of arrogance and megalomania, saying Berlin has to change its course towards Kiev. Navy chief K. Achim Schockenbach was forced to apologize and step down after calling Russia an important country whose president deserves respect. He had also dismissed as nonsense the West claims that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. The German Defense Ministry publicly criticized his remarks, saying that they did not reflect Berlin's position. Still, the country enraged Ukraine by refusing to deliver arms to it. Ukraine has been a hotbed of tensions between Russia and the West, led by the U.S. We reached out to political analyst John Bosnich for comments about the ongoing tensions over Ukraine, and here's what he had to say.
I would suggest that the Anglo-American engagement in Ukraine is actually an effort to break up the growing friendship between Germany and Russia. And if you see this entire operation in that light, you get a broader geopolitical perspective. And this explains why Germany is unwilling to send weapons to the regime in Kiev. And it also explains why Germany is not even willing to allow English overflight of weapons being sent to the regime in Kiev.
Moving on, the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen has denied bombing a prison in the northern city of Sada on Friday. Now, international aid agency Doctors Without Borders says there is no way to deny the strike. Everyone in Sada has heard it. The agency says that the attack was the latest, quote, unjustifiable airstrikes by the coalition in Yemen. MSF says those airstrikes have hit places like schools, hospitals, markets, and wedding parties. In a statement, the MSF also speaks about what it calls the terrible effects of indiscriminate coalition bombing, including on its own hospitals. The Sada airstrike left at least 82 people dead and scores wounded. It drew widespread condemnation with the latest from Italy. The country says it is urgent to stop the Yemen conflict, which is causing suffering and victims among the civilian population. Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a protest rally in solidarity with the people of Yemen who are reeling from years of bloody Saudi-led war. The rally organized by the Islamic Jihad movement called for a stop to the deadly aggression against Yemeni civilians. Organizers said the Saudi war is at the service of the Israeli regime and is aimed at bringing the people of Yemen to their knees. They said the Saudi-led coalition has explicitly endorsed a massacre of Yemeni people with this devastating war. Iraq's popular mobilization units launched a large-scale security operation in the east of the country after a deadly attack by Daesh terrorists there. The PMU says intelligence, artillery, and explosive disposal units are participating in the operation in Al-Azim district, Diyala province. It says that occasional attacks by Daesh only strengthen the PMU's resolve to hunt the terrorists down and counter them. Early on Friday, Daesh attacks an army barracks in Diyala, killing 7 soldiers. That was the deadliest attack by the terror group in Iraq this year. Daesh was largely eliminated there in December 2017 after 3 years of campaign, which the PMU played a great role in. The Takfiri group has remained active through sleeper cells launching sporadic attacks. Meanwhile, the Daesh terror group has recently carried out attacks in Syria and Iraq. This may be regarded as an attempt to reorganize and rebuild its structure. The group was eliminated back in 2017, but what has really caused the group's resurgence and what can be done to tackle it? That and more in the following report.
On Friday, the Daesh terror group staged an attack on an army base in Iraq's eastern province of Diyala, leaving at least 11 soldiers dead. The attack happened overnight, and many, including Iraqi provincial officials, blame the army for being caught unprepared. This has been the deadliest operation the terrorist group has launched in Iraq so far this year. Last month, the terror group killed 10 people in a northern village following an October raid that left 11 people dead and several wounded in a village in Diyala. A day prior to the Friday attack in Iraq, Daesh terrorists launched another assault, this time in Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka. It was an attempt by the group to help freeze prisoners held by the U.S.-backed Kurdish-led Syrian forces, or SDF. Over 20 Kurdish security forces were killed in the attack. Several civilians also lost their lives. The Daesh terror group was almost eliminated in Iraq and Syria in 2017, but pockets of the group remained in the two countries. The foreign-backed militants have carried out regular attacks against Kurdish and government targets in Syria since the rump of its territory was overrun on the banks of the Euphrates in 2019. In recent months, the group's sleeper cells have become more active in both countries, claiming attacks that killed scores of Iraqis and Syrians. In Syria, Most of such operations have been launched against military and oil installations, but the Hasaka prison attack could mark a new phase in the group's resurgence. Security forces warn that Daesh will continue to regroup to stage even more deadly attacks, while senior military commanders are concerned that the raids may further expand in the region. But what is really behind the rise of Daesh again? In Syria, the group maintains presence in desert hideouts in the country's east, where US forces are also stationed. This as the Syrian government is only supported by its allies to fight the terror group, while the international community has failed to provide any assistance in the fight. And as to Iraq, the US claimed to be there to stand strong against Daesh, yet again it failed to do anything concrete to prevent the group's resurgence and its terror attacks. However, it seems clear that the popular groups in Iraq and Syria, who played a crucial role in defeating Daesh back in 2017 in the absence of the international community's contribution, can once again bring the terror group to its knees.
Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal carry on talks in Vienna to revive the accord that got into trouble after the U.S. withdrawal. The ongoing talks are part of the eighth round of the negotiations that kicked off in April last year. Iran says the negotiations should result in the removal of sanctions the U.S. imposed following its 2018 pullout. Homa Lezgi is joining us right now from the Austrian capital to tell us more. Homa?
Yes, Kisu. The eighth round of these talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are still ongoing. And today we had news that for the first time, there is a meeting taking place between all of the participants in these talks, of course, minus the U.S., which is indirectly involved. So a meeting taking place today between Iran and the 4+1, as well as the EU, but it's not officially in the format of the joint commission session. So they're all meeting, and we're hearing that they've been discussing the issue of guarantees and verification. We have been, of course, reading lately that these two issues are among two of the main sticking points in these talks because, as you know, Iran has said it wants verified sanctions removal, and it wants to be able to verify the effective lifting of the sanctions before it goes back to its nuclear commitments. Some sources were saying that is it possible to give any kind of legal guarantee? Some saying that that was not going to happen, others saying that there were problems in the wording, how this could be worded in the text of this agreement. And there are ideas or proposals on the table, initiatives coming, some sources say mainly from Iran, on how this issue or this problem can be solved, especially the problem of guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the deal again or that it will not reimpose sanctions. And this is, of course, because of the experience that Iran had under the Trump administration, because Trump not only withdrew from the JCPOA, violating the UN Security Council resolution that supported this agreement, but also imposed sanctions and the maximum pressure campaign, which led to even more economic pressure on the country. And Iran says because secondary US sanctions are affecting how foreign international companies are going to work with Iran, it wants to have assurances that when the sanctions are removed on paper, that in practice these companies will be able to invest in Iran, will not be concerned about the future of their investments in the country with, for instance, the change of U.S. government. If Biden goes and a Republican comes in power, what's going to happen to their investments? Are they going to be put under U.S. sanctions? You know, so this is a question that Iran understandably wants to have resolved. So at the same time, we're hearing that Western officials and sources close to the Europeans or the Americans have been saying that timing is important, that they believe if an agreement is not made within the next weeks, then there's no point in continuing these talks. The Russian ambassador, Mikhail Oryanov, in response to these reports, said he believes that timing should not be the determining factor in these talks, and it's important not to make this time issue so important that it would jeopardize, you know, a future restored JCPOA. We're also hearing, and I'll quickly add this, Gisu, that some American media reports, one report from NBC News had confirmed that a member of Rob Malley, the US's team, Mr. Richard Nephew, had withdrawn from his team, and he is known and was known as the architect of US sanctions against Iran. And they were reporting that this is, was because of differences that he had with Rob Malley when it comes to the direction of these talks. Some sources close to the Iranians have said that there are differences now, this is a sign of differences, not just in the, between Americans and the Europeans, but also in the American team itself. The important thing, Iran also says, is that when it comes to its nuclear commitment, its red line is the limits set within the JCPOA. It will not give up its right, for instance, for research and development, and it will not give any nuclear commitments beyond what it's already pledged to do under the JCPOA.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Homa Lezgi, live from Vienna. Moving on, Venezuela is increasing its oil output thanks to Iran aiding the Latin American nation evade U.S. sanctions. Industry analysts confirm that Venezuelan oil production has doubled in recent months. They say the output reached an average of 900,000 barrels per day in December last year, a steep rise from the previous months. Industry sources estimate that Caracas will be able to maintain that volume in January. They believe regular shipments of thinners from Iran have greatly helped Venezuela boost its production. The thinners are essential to reduce the thickness of super-heavy crude. Both Iran and Venezuela are under U.S. sanctions. U.S. President Joe Biden is once again in a hot seat, this time for failing to control gun-related crimes. Violent survivors are calling on him to take bigger steps on gun control after the nation saw nearly 45,000 deaths during his first year of presidency. That is nearly three times the number of gun deaths during the former President Donald Trump's first year in the White House. On Friday, survivors of the 2018 Parkland school shooting released a statement slamming Biden for the whopping number of deaths related to gun crime. He called on the U.S. president to, quote, end the epidemic of gun violence. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev Desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly cause a degeneration of its materials. The Dimona core, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they have not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or LA Confidential. He was also good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top-secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. Sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vananu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vananu M was hijacked in Rome. Vananu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vananu was Cheryl Bentor. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vananu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordechai Vananu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vananu Mordechai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. A 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vananu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vananu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. adjacent to the reactor is Institute Number 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute Number 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute Number 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute Number 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordecai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it's conserved as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute Number 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute Number 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute Number 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute Number 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground, are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal, the manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just as shot by Vanunu, the process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vanunu. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanunu walked about Institute Number 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level number 4, Vanunu revealed the production of tritium, used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanunu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanunu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Tal Afar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story. diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. Doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Barsem Saadi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. Yeah. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbors? While we were filming with Bassam Saadi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumors. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumors in Berlin with Xanthe Hall.
200 cubic meters a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic meters of waste, radioactive waste, have been, that's the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, it's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic meters. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, And in particularly the children would be badly affected because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the second intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine, and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. And by continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that is perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Join us next time for another documentary right here. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend, an Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear Sayyid, we'll again be talking about the subject of how we can raise our children without employing any violent manners, and we do so because it is a very important subject and it's a very important lesson for the dear parents to understand that hitting your children is not permissible in any way, shape, or form in Islam. Last, we spoke about some preventative measures we can employ to avoid having situations where we may be agitated enough to lash out on our children. One of these ways was saying that it is very important that we engage the mind of the child. We should not leave any free time for the child to do whatever they want out of boredom, because then bad things will happen, unfortunately. So take them to the club, teach them something, teach them a skill, or whatever it may be, just to employ their mind. And if the children are nagging, following a punishment, for example, it is very important that the parents should show them that their efforts are futile by ignoring the child, because by then the child will understand that nagging is not going to lead to anything. Dear Sayyid, what else must we keep in mind?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد وعجل فرجه. So just to refresh the memory of the listeners that we said in Islam, it is absolutely forbidden to harm a child physically in any way, shape, or form.
Or any other human being for that
matter. Or any other human being in that matter. Yeah. Or even emotionally, it's also forbidden. But at least physically, we know that you have to pay gold.
Right.
So we try to find preventive measures and ways where we can try to apply in our lives and with our kids to make sure that we don't resort to violence and hitting children.
Right.
So we mentioned a few. So inshallah, let's mention a few more inshallah. As well.
Is anger management one of them for the parents? Anger management classes.
It is.
Well, very good.
We will come to that in a minute.
Right.
So we did say that before that we have to encourage positive certain ethics and behaviors in the child.
Right. Yeah.
We did say that we have to create something for them to do, give them a purpose. And we have to work on the fact that we need to give them support when it comes to their self-building as well. So as a child, he wants to do things and achieve things.
Right.
You give him the support to do what he wants, to have that ability in himself, and you take his self-esteem to a higher level.
Hold that thought, dear Sayyid. We'll be continuing after a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening into the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing ways to raise our children without using violence. Dear Sayyid, just before going on a break, you were saying that...
So I was saying that when it comes to kids, we need to give them the support that they require in order for them to have, motivation and self-confidence in themselves. Right. One of the ways that we could encourage our kids to have self-confidence in themselves is the fact that we choose activities or get them to do things that
they are good
we
at.
We know that they are either good at or they can do.
Right.
Right. So what happens is they end up doing it, they end up achieving it, and as a result, me and you, we give them the encouragement, we give them the, all the nice words, all the applause that they require, and therefore, they feel a lot better about themselves.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so even though we created the scenario ourselves, now the child, he feels more in touch, he feels more stronger, he feels more empowered, he feels a lot of good things.
Yeah.
And this is what we want to do. We want to create a lot of good things, if you remember we spoke about that.
Yeah.
So it overtakes the bad things, but obviously, I mean, don't overdo the... the compliments.
Yeah,
it has to be within limits, because otherwise, it could lead to
self-conceit,
spoiling, and like self-conceit, or all the things that we're trying to avoid in the first place.
Yeah,
so that's also another thing. Amongst the other preventive measures that we can use is we need to teach the child to learn to control his anger and be calm himself whenever he gets angry,
right.
Which obviously would lead me and you to becoming an angry ourselves, and obviously being balanced with a child.
Yeah.
So we need to learn to teach the children to relax and calm down when they're angry. For example, right. You know, if a child gets angry, hold him, touch his hand, for example. Set him down, tell him it's okay, let's find out what's wrong. So that itself
should also then help them.
The situation.
Should also only teach them how to calm down, but should also actively help to make them calm, right?
Yeah, exactly. So either way works.
Right.
So when you do teach them how to become calm and relax and control their anger, obviously, that would save you a lot of problems as well when they get angry. So you don't have to, you know, go and punch them in the face and what have you, or breaking around things.
Whatever your solution was beforehand.
Yeah, so just that itself, just telling the kids that you're, you know, to learn to control themselves also will do a lot of wonders, which a lot of people don't do.
Right.
I mean, even we have a hadith from the Prophet, he says, if someone gets angry, touch them.
Yeah.
There's like, I don't know, subhanAllah.
Touch their hands.
Especially with relatives. If you touch them while they're angry, they kind of cool down. So this is also another preventive measure that we can try to apply in our life to avoid violence.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to employ different manners of raising, teaching, and educating our children that are not violent. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
Another preventive measure with children is showing them emotion. Okay? The child himself, he needs love and care. And so what happens to him when he gets in a situation or situations where he feels danger, he feels worry, he feels nervousness.
Right.
So obviously, and hormones in his body go high, and you know, he starts to react to the hormones in his body. So, you know, he would need a lot of affection, a lot of love, to accommodate for all these feelings.
Right.
Okay. And the more you come to him, the more you try to help him out, the easier he will feel. Then the better you will feel, because you know sometimes. A lot of people find it very hard dealing with kids, for example, who have fear phobia, for example, of darkness or dark rooms or closed doors or what have you. And sometimes the parents get really frustrated with this.
Yeah.
So sometimes if the child is going through a certain fear, a certain emotional problem, usually that drives his hormones to high level. I mean, so you need to find a way to show them love, show them support, so show them compassion.
This is a basic human skill, dear Sayyid, to show anyone. Some people show they show the skill to their animals when they're scared of thunder, whatever it is. They go and comfort them and whatever. So we apply the same, but even more so because it's a human child. Comfort them.
Of course. It's just a human need.
Right.
And like I said, in doing so, that should save you a lot of problem. Should save you a lot of anger.
In the long
run. And it should save you, hopefully, from hitting a child. Because the more safer the child feels around you, the more he will cooperate with you, the more he will do what you want him to do.
Right.
As simple as that. So we can also put that in our bucket list when it comes to trying to avoid violence our kids.
Right.
Also, we need to create, along this note, a sense of respect between the son and the child, and obviously from a younger age as well. You create that bond between the father and the mother and the child themselves when it comes to dealing with one another.
Right.
The way we talk, the way we communicate, the way we look at each other, the way we interact in the house. So all these things, if the child is get taught from a young age about them and learns to respect his father in the house,
right,
that always saves a father from many issues and many problems.
Right.
He knows that he should not raise his voice over his dad. He knows to be quiet when his dad is talking, for example. He knows that this particular, for example, method, his dad hates.
Right.
And so on and so forth. Knowing these things, and the father also knows what makes his child not happy.
Right.
Right? Or things that his child might hate. And then you have this mutual respect between the two.
Right.
So my dad respects my privacy, and in return, I respect my dad.
Right,
you know what I mean? If my dad disrespects my privacy, I'm not going to respect him in something else.
A symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, so you would have this respect between the two of you that should also help to act as a preventer from having to resort to violence.
And with that in mind, dear listeners, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.